This is audiobook in format MP3 of Magic and Mystery in Tibet by Alexandra David Neal. Extracts. First published 1931. Download the PDF of the book to follow the text. Read here to sharpen concentration on the content. If losing track, stop the audio and seek a word heard via search or find function of the PDF program until finding the right place. In Adobe Reader, it is usually under the edit in the top menu. Introduction. For many Westerners, Tibet is wrapped in an atmosphere of mystery. The land of snows is for them the country of the unknown, the fantastic and the impossible. What superhuman powers have not been ascribed to the various kinds of lames, magicians, sorcerers, necromancers and practitioners of the occult who inhabit those high table lands, and whom both nature and their own deliberate purpose have so splendidly isolated from the rest of the world. And how readily are the strangest legends about them accepted as indisputable truths. In that country, plants, animals and human beings seem to divert to their own purposes the best established laws of physics, chemistry, physiology and even plain common sense. It is therefore quite natural that scholars accustomed to the strict discipline of experimental method should have paid to these stories merely the condescending and amused attention that is usually given to fairy tales. Such was my own state of mind up to the day when I had the good fortune to make the acquaintance of Madame Alexandra David Neal. This well-known and courageous explorer of Tibet unites in herself all the physical, moral and intellectual qualities that could be desired in one who is to observe and examine a subject of this kind. I must insist on saying this, however much her modesty may suffer. Madame David Neal understands, writes and speaks fluently all the dialects of Tibet. She has spent 14 consecutive years in the country and the neighboring regions. She is a professed Buddhist, and so has been able to gain the confidence of the most important lamas. Her adopted son is an ordained lame, and she herself has undergone the psychic exercises of which she speaks. Madame David Neal has in fact become, as she herself says, a complete Asiatic, and, what is still more important for an explorer of a country hitherto inaccessible to foreign travelers, she is recognized as such by those among whom she has lived. This Easterner, this complete Tibetan, has nevertheless remained a Westerner, a disciple of Descartes and of Claude Bernard, practicing the philosophic skepticism of the former which, according to the latter, should be the constant ally of the scientific observer. Unencumbered by any preconceived theory, and unbiased by any doctrine or dogma, Madame David Neal has observed everything in Tibet in a free and impartial spirit. In the lectures which, in my capacity as professor of the Collège de France, succeeding my master Claude Bernard, I asked her to deliver, Madame David Neal sums up her conclusions in these words: everything that relates, whether closely or more distantly, to psychic phenomena and to the action of psychic forces in general, should be studied just like any other science. There is nothing miraculous or supernatural in them, nothing that should engender or keep alive superstition. Psychic training, rationally and scientifically conducted, can lead to desirable results. That is why the information gained about such training, even though it is practiced empirically and based on theories to which we cannot always give assent, constitutes useful documentary evidence worthy of our attention. Here, it is clear, is a true scientific determinism, as far removed from skepticism as from blind credulity. The studies of Madame David Neal will be of interest to Orientalists, psychologists and physiologists alike. This was written by Dr. A. D'Arsonville, professor of the Collège de France. Author's Preface. Immediately after the publication of my account of my journey to Lhasa, many persons expressed a wish, both in articles devoted to my book and in private conversation, to know how I came to live among the lamas, and also to learn more about the doctrines and practices of the mystics and magicians of Tibet. In this book I attempt to satisfy their friendly curiosity. This task is however fraught with certain difficulties, owing to the limited space at my disposal. In order to answer these two questions in the order in which they have been put to me, I have started by describing the events which brought me into contact with the religious world of the lamas and of the various kinds of magicians who surround them. Next, I have tried to group together a certain number of salient points concerning the occult and mystical theories and the psychic training practices of the Tibetans. Whenever I have discovered in the rich store of my recollections a fact bearing on these subjects, I have related it as it came. Consequently, the book is not a record of travel, for the subject does not lend itself to that treatment. In the course of such investigations as I have pursued, the information obtained on one particular day is sometimes not completed till several months or several years later. It is only by presenting the final results of information gathered in various places that one can hope to give an adequate idea of the subject I am describing. It is my intention, later on, to treat the question of Tibetan mysticism and philosophy in a more technical work. As in my previous book, My Journey to Lhasa, the Tibetan names are generally transcribed phonetically only. The few cases in which the Tibetan orthography has been indicated will show how the correct pronunciation deviates from the spelling. Chapter 1, Tibet and the Lamas. Well, then, it is understood. I leave Dewasend up with you as interpreter. He will accompany you to Gangtok. Is it a man who is speaking to me? This short yellow-skinned being clad in a robe of orange brocade, a diamond star sparkling on his hat, is he not, rather, a genie come down from the neighboring mountains? They say he is an incarnated lama and heir prince of a Himalayan throne, but I doubt his reality. Probably he will vanish like a mirage, with his caparisoned little steed and his party of followers, dressed in all the colors of the rainbow. He is a part of the enchantment in which I have lived these last 15 days. This new episode is of the stuff that dreams are made of. In a few minutes, I shall wake up in a real bed, in some country not haunted by genii nor by incarnated lamas wrapped in shimmering silk. A country where men wear ugly dark coats and the horses do not carry silver inlaid saddles on golden yellow cloths. The sound of a kettle drum makes me start. Two hautboys intone a melancholy minor tune. The youthful genie straddles his diminutive courser, knights and squires jump into their saddles. I shall expect you, the Lama Prince says, smiling graciously at me. I hear myself, as if I were listening to some other person, promising him that I will start the next day for his capital, and the little troop, headed by the musicians, disappears. As the last murmurs of the plaintive melody die away in the distance, the enchantment that has held me spellbound dissipates. I have not been dreaming, all this is real. I am at Klimpong, in the Himalayas, and the interpreter given me when I arrived stands at my side. I have already related, in a previous book, my journey to Lhasa, the circumstances which had brought me to their Himalayas. Political reasons had at that time led the Dalai Lama to seek refuge in British territory. It had seemed to me a unique opportunity, while he was stopping at the Indian frontier, of obtaining an interview and getting information from him about the special type of Buddhism that prevails in Tibet. Very few strangers have ever approached the monk king hidden in his sacred city, in the land of snows. Even in exile, he saw no one. Up to the time of my visit, he had obstinately refused an audience to any woman except Tibetans, and I believe, even to this day, that I am the only exception to this rule. As I left Darjeeling, in the early rosy dawn of a cool spring morning, I little guessed the far-reaching consequences of my request. I thought of a short excursion, of an interesting but brief interview, while, actually, I became involved in wanderings that kept me in Asia for full 14 years. At the beginning of that long series of journeys, the Dalai Lama figures, in my diaries, as an obliging host who, seeing a stranger without the walls, invites him to see over his domain. This, the Dalai Lama did in a few words, learn the Tibetan language, he told me. If one could believe his subjects who call him the Omniscient, the Sovereign of Tibet, when giving me this advice, foresaw its consequences, and consciously directed me, not only towards Lhasa, his forbidden capital, but towards the mystic masters and unknown magicians, yet more closely hidden in his wonderland. At Kalimpong, The Lama King lived in a large house belonging to the minister of the Raja of Bhutan. To give the place a more majestic appearance, two rows of tall bamboo poles had been planted in the form of an avenue. Flags flew from every pole, with the inscription Om Mani Padme Hum, or the horse of the air, surrounded by magic formulas. The suite of the exiled sovereign was numerous and included more than 100 servants. They were for the most part engaged in interminable gossip, and choir trained round the habitation. But on fete days, or when visitors of rank were to be received, a crowd of busy officials and domestics poured out from all sides, peering at one from every window, crossing and recrossing the large plot of ground in front of the house, hurrying, screaming, agitated, and all so remarkably alike in their dirty, greasy robes, that a stranger could easily make awkward mistakes about their rank. The splendor, decorum and etiquette of the potala were absent in that land of exile. Those who saw this roadside camp, where the head of the Tibetan theocracy waited for his subjects to reconquer his throne, could not imagine what the court at Lhasa was like. The British expedition penetrating into the forbidden territory and parading his capital, in spite of the sorcery of the most famous magicians, had probably led the Dalai Lama to understand that foreign barbarians were masters in a material sense, by right of force. The inventions that he noticed during his trip through India must also have convinced him of their ability to enslave and mold the material elements of nature. But his conviction that the white race is mentally inferior remained unshaken. And, in this, he only shared the opinion of all Asiatics, from Ceylon to the northern confines of Mongolia. A Western woman acquainted with Buddhist doctrines seemed to him an inconceivable phenomenon. If I had vanished into space while talking to him, he would have been less astonished. My reality surprised him most, but, when finally convinced, he politely inquired after my master, assuming that I could only have learned of Buddha from an Asiatic. It was not easy to convince him that the Tibetan text of one of the most esteemed Buddhist books had been translated into French before I was born. Ah well, he murmured at last, if a few strangers have really learned our language and read our sacred books, they must have missed the meaning of them. This was my chance. I hastened to seize it. It is precisely because I suspect that certain religious doctrines of Tibet have been misunderstood that I have come to you to be enlightened, I said. My reply pleased the Dalai Lama. He readily answered any questions I put to him, and a little later gave me a long written explanation of the various subjects we had discussed. The Prince of Sikkim and his escort having disappeared, it only remained for me to keep my promise and make ready to start for Gangtok. But there was something to be seen before moving on. The evening before, I had witnessed the benediction of the pilgrims by the Dalai Lama, a widely different scene from the pontifical benediction at Rome. For the Pope in a single gesture blesses the multitude, while the Tibetans are far more exacting and each expect an individual blessing. Among Lamaists again the manner of the blessing varies with the social rank of the blessed. The Lama places both hands on the heads of those he most respects. In other cases only one hand, two fingers or even only one finger. Lastly comes the blessing given by slightly touching the head with colored ribbons, attached to a short stick. In every case, however, there is contact, direct or indirect, between the Lama and the devotee. This contact, according to Lamaists, is indispensable because the benediction, whether of people or of things, is not meant to call down upon them the benediction of God but to infuse into them some beneficial power that emanates from the Lama. The large number of people who came to Klimpong to be touched by the Dalai Lama gave me some idea of his widespread prestige. The procession took several hours to pass before him, and I noticed that not only Lamaists but many people from Nepal and from Bengal, belonging to Hindu sects, had joined the crowd. I saw some, who had come only to look on, suddenly seized by an occult fervor, hurrying to join the pious flock. As I was watching this scene, my eyes fell on a man seated on the ground, a little to one side. His matted hair was wound around his head like a turban, in the style common to Hindu ascetics. Yet, His features were not those of an Indian, and he was wearing dirty and much torn lamaist monastic garments. This tramp had placed a small bag beside him and seemed to observe the crowd with a cynical expression. I pointed him out to Dawes and Up, asking him if he had any idea who this Himalayan Diogenes might be. It must be a travelling Naljorpa. He laughed noisily. He answered, and, seeing my curiosity, my obliging interpreter went to the man and entered into conversation with him. He returned to me with a serious face and said, this Lama is a peripatetic ascetic from Bhutan. He lives here and there in caves, empty houses or under the trees. He has been stopping for several days in a small monastery near here. My thoughts returned to the vagabond when the prince and his escort had disappeared. I had no definite plan for the afternoon. Why should I not go to the Gampa monastery where he was staying, and persuade him to talk? Was he really mocking, as he seemed to be, at the Dalai Lama and the faithful? And if so, why? There might be interesting reasons. I communicated my desire to Dawes and Up, who agreed to accompany me. We went on horseback and soon reached the Gompa, which was only a large-sized country house. In the Lakang 6. The room containing the holy images, Thangkas 6, we found an Naljorpa seated upon a cushion in front of a low table, finishing his meal. Cushions were brought and we were offered tea. It was difficult to begin a conversation with the ascetic, as his mouth appeared to be full of rice. He had only answered our polite greetings by a kind of grunt. I was trying to find a phrase to break the ice, when the strange fellow began to laugh and muttered a few words. Dawes and Up seemed embarrassed. What does he say? I asked. Excuse me, answered the interpreter, these Naljorpas sometimes speak roughly. I do not know if I should translate. Please do, I replied. I am here to take notes, especially of anything at all curious and original. Well, then excuse me, he said, what is this idiot here for? Such rudeness did not greatly astonish me as, in India also, certain yogins make a habit of insulting anyone who approaches them. Tell him I have come to ask why he mocked at the crowd seeking the benediction of the Dalai Lama, puffed up with a sense of their own importance and the importance of what they are doing. Insects fluttering in the dung, muttered the Naljorpa between his teeth. This was vague, but the kind of language one expects from such men. And you, I replied, are you free from all defilement? He who tries to get out only sinks in deeper. I roll in it like a pig. I digest it and turn it into golden dust, into a brook of pure water. To fashion stars out of dog dung, that is the great work. Evidently my friend was enjoying himself. This was his way of posing as a superman. Are these pilgrims not right, to profit by the presence of the Dalai Lama and obtain his blessing? They are simple folk incapable of aspiring to the knowledge of the higher doctrines. But the Naljorpa interrupted me. For a blessing to be efficacious, he who gives it must possess the power that he professes to communicate. Would the precious protector, the Dalai Lama, need soldiers to fight the Chinese or other enemies if he possessed such a power? Could he not drive anyone he liked out of the country and surround Tibet with an invisible barrier that none could pass? The guru who is born in a lotus had such a power, and his blessing still reaches those who worship him, even though he lives in the distant land of the Rakshasas. I am only a humble disciple. It appeared to me that the humble disciple was maybe a little mad and certainly very conceited, for his and yet had been accompanied by a glance that suggested many things. My interpreter meanwhile was visibly uneasy. He profoundly respected the Dalai Lama and disliked to hear him criticized. On the other hand, the man who could create stars out of dog dung inspired him with a superstitious fear. I proposed to leave, but as I understood that the Lama was going away the next morning, I handed Dawes and Up a few rupees for the traveler to help him on his way. This present displeased the Naljorpa. He refused it, saying he had already received more provisions than he could carry. Dawes and Up thought it right to insist. He took a few steps forward, intending to place the money on a table near the Lama. Then I saw him stagger, fall backward and strike his back against the wall as if he had been violently pushed. He uttered a cry and clutched at his stomach. The Naljorpa got up and, sneering, left the room. "I feel as if I had received a terrible blow," said to Wiz and up. "The Lama is irritated. How shall we appease him?"
"Let us go," I answered.
"The Lama has probably nothing to do with it. You, perhaps, have heart trouble and you'd better consult a doctor."
Pale and troubled, the interpreter answered nothing.
Indeed, there was nothing to be said. We returned, but I was not able to reassure him. The next day the Wasandup and I left for Gangtok. The mule path that we followed dives right into the Himalayas, the sacred land which ancient Indian traditions people with famous sagas, stern magicians, ascetics and deities. The summer resorts established by foreigners on the border of these impressive highlands have not yet modified their aspect. A few miles away from the hotels where the Western world enjoys dancing and jazz bands, the primeval forest reigns. Shrouded in the moving fogs, a fantastic army of trees, draped in livid green moss, seems to keep watch along the narrow tracks, warning or threatening the traveler with enigmatic gestures. From the low valleys buried under the exuberant jungle to the mountain summits covered with eternal snow, the whole country is bathed in occult influences. In such scenery it is fitting that sorcery should hold sway. The so-called Buddhist population is practically shamanist and a large number of mediums, bonpos, powwows, bunting and yabos of both sexes, even in the smallest hamlets transmit the messages of gods, demons and the dead. I slept on the way at Pekiong, and the next day I reached Gangtok. As I neared this village capital, I was greeted by a sudden and formidable hailstorm. Tibetans think that meteorological phenomena are the work of demons or magicians. A hailstorm is one of their favorite weapons. The former use it to hinder pilgrims on their journey to holy places and the latter by this means, defend their hermitages against intruders and keep off faint-hearted candidates for discipleship. A few weeks after my arrival, the superstitious Dewasandup confessed that he had consulted Mpa about the unexpected attack of hail upon the otherwise gloriously sunny day of my arrival. The oracle declared that the local gods and the holy lamas were not hostile to me, but that, nevertheless, I should meet with many difficulties if I attempted to live in the land of the religion, as Tibetans call their country. A prediction very generously fulfilled. He believed to be the reincarnation of his uncle, a lama of saintly memory. As usual, he had donned the monastic garb while still a child, and spent a part of his youth in the monastery of which he was now the head. The British government having chosen him, in preference to his elder brother, as successor to the Maharaja his father, he was put in charge of an anglicized Indian as guardian and teacher. A short stay at Oxford and a trip round the world completed his heterogeneous education. Sidkong Tulku. In Tibetan language, titles or other honors follow the name. Now, the peasant clergy of these forests are generally poor and ill-fed, and it is difficult for them to suppress a thrill of delight when the death of a rich villager promises them several days' feast. 11 knew English better than his mother tongue, Tibetan. He spoke Hindustani fluently and, also, a little Chinese. The private villa he had built in his father's gardens resembled an English country house unhoused on a Tibetan temple. The same contrasts were repeated within. The ground floor was furnished according to English taste, while upstairs there was an oratory with lamaist images and a Tibetan sitting room. The young prince was very open-minded. He immediately became interested in my researches and facilitated my task with great zeal. The first part of my stay in Sikkim was devoted to visiting the monasteries scattered through the forests. Picturesquely situated, usually on the spur of a mountain, their aspect impressed me deeply. I like to imagine these rustic dwellings inhabited by thinkers liberated from worldly ambitions and struggles, who passed their days in peace and deep meditations. I did not, however, find the monasteries quite what I expected. The monks of Sikkim are for the most part illiterate and have no desire to be enlightened, even about the Buddhism which they profess. Nor, indeed, have they the necessary leisure. The Gompas of Sikkim are poor, they have but a very small income and no rich benefactors.
Their trappers are compelled to work for their living. Foreign authors call all members of the Lamaist clergy indiscriminately lamas, but this is not the custom in Tibet. The only monks who have a right to the title of lama. Nevertheless, it is usual to give the courtesy title of lama to aged and learned monks when addressing them. In Sikkim, a number of trappers whom their colleagues held to be learned men were capable of celebrating a few religious rites. They taught the novices to recite the liturgy and received as fees gifts in kind, more rarely a little money and, often, merely the domestic service of their pupils. However, the exercise of their priestly functions was the main source of their income. Orthodox Buddhism strictly forbids religious rites, and the learned lamas acknowledge that they cannot bestow spiritual enlightenment, which can only be acquired by personal intellectual effort. Yet the majority believe in the efficacy of certain ritualistic methods of the healing of the sick, securing material prosperity, the conquest of evil beings and the guidance of the spirits of the dead in the other world. The funeral ceremonies were the principal duty of the Himalayan monks. They celebrated these rites with zeal, even with pleasure, for they include one or two banquets offered by the family of the dead to the monks of the monastery to which he had been attached. The officiating trappers also receive presents of money and in kind at the house of the dead man. Grown-up men usually dissimulate their feelings, but the child novices who guard the cattle in the woods are amusingly frank. One day, while I was sitting not far from some of these youthful herdsmen, a far-off sound of wind instruments reached us. In an instant, the boys who had been playing stopped listening attentively. Again, we heard the same sound. The children had understood. "The conches," said one of them. "Someone is dead," another answered. Then they kept silent, looking at each other, their eyes sparkling with pleasure. "We shall have meat to eat," one of the boys whispered. In many villages, the Lamaist priest comes into competition with the sorcerer, though as a rule this leads to no animosity. Generally, each has more or less faith in the worth of his rival's methods. Although the lama is held in higher esteem than the boil sorcerer, a follower of the ancient religion of the Aborigines, or than the Ngagspa, magician, assimilated to the official clergy, these latter are, nevertheless, believed to be more skillful in dealing with the demons who harm living beings or the spirits of the dead. An unforeseen incident led me to discover how the spirit of a dead man is drawn out of his body by the officiating lama and directed on the right road in the next world. I was returning, that day, from an excursion in the forest when I heard a sharp, brief cry, unlike that of any animal known to me. A few minutes later, the same cry was twice repeated. I advanced slowly and noiselessly in the direction of the sound and discovered a cabin which had been hidden by a slight rise in the ground. Lying flat between the bushes, I could observe what was going on without being seen. Two monks were seated under the trees, their gaze lowered in an attitude of meditation. "Hick!" cried one upon a peculiar abnormal shrill note. "Hick!" repeated the other after a few minutes. And so they continued, with long intervals of silence, during which they remained motionless between the shrieks. I noticed that a great effort seemed required to produce this sound, which apparently came up from their very entrails. After having watched them for some time, I saw one of the trappers put his hands upon his throat. His face expressed suffering. He turned his head to one side and spat out a stream of blood. His companion said a few words that I could not hear. Without answering, the monk rose and went towards the cabin. I then noticed a long straw standing straight up on the top of his head. What did this ornament signify? While the traps entered the hut and his friend had his back to me, I escaped. As soon as I saw the ascend up, I questioned him. What were these men doing? Why did they utter this strange cry? "That," he said, "is the ritualistic cry that the officiating lama shouts beside a man who has just died, in order to free the spirit and cause it to leave the body through a hole that this magic syllable opens on the summit of the skull. Only a lama who has received, from a competent master, the power of uttering that hick, with the right intonation and required force, is capable of success. After hick, he shouts fat. but he must be careful not to articulate fat when he is only practicing, like the monks you overheard. The combination of these two sounds invariably leads to the separation of body and spirit, so that the lama who pronounced them correctly over himself would immediately die.